Welcome to Central Line, Leadership in Healthcare, the show that shares stories, experiences, and advice from notable and innovative leaders in healthcare. Leading in healthcare is incredibly challenging. So if you are looking to learn firsthand from nurses, physicians, administrators, and other healthcare professionals in leadership and management roles, this is the podcast for you. Hosted by Leah Wutchik, leadership development expert, executive coach, healthcare professional, and president and co-founder of Tall Trees Leadership. We talk with today's successful healthcare leaders on how they get to where they are, lessons learned along the way, and what it takes to thrive as a successful leader in healthcare. Let's get started with your host, Leah Wutchik.
Rear Admiral, retired, the Honorable Rebecca Patterson, is a 34-year Canadian Armed Forces veteran. A registered nurse by training, Senator Patterson enjoyed a rewarding career with the Canadian Armed Forces. As a provider and executive health leader, she worked in military healthcare delivery, education, training, and operational and strategic planning, both at home and on international deployments. On promotion to Flag General Officer, she was the first person with a military nursing background ever lead at that rank. With a passion for service, Senator Patterson has led in many different domains in the Canadian Armed Forces. From serving as the defense champion for women, addressing sexual misconduct, and leading cultural change efforts in the Canadian Armed Forces, to commanding Canada's 14th health system, the Canadian Forces Health Service, at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, she has always been focused on creating healthy work environments and uplifting others. She has been a strong advocate to transform the culture, eliminate harmful behavior, and re-establish public trust in the Canadian military. Senator Patterson was awarded the Meritorious Service Medal from the Governor General of Canada in 2014 and inducted as an officer in the Order of Military Merit in 2018. She's also the recipient of numerous other honors and awards, including the Ontario Premier's Award for Excellence in Health Sciences for Ontario College graduates and the Niagara College Canada Distinguished Alumni Award. She remains an active member of the College of Nurses of Ontario, the Canadian College of Health Leaders, and the Royal Canadian Medical Service Association. Senator Patterson is now the first Canadian Armed Forces woman veteran to be appointed to the Senate of Canada, where she remains committed to serving Canadians and ensuring Canadian Armed Forces members, their families, and veterans have their voice represented. She lives in Ottawa with her family.
Hello, Senator Patterson. How are you?
I'm doing very well today. How are you on this hot July day?
It is hot. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for being here at Central Line Leadership in Healthcare. I am thrilled to bits to have you, and I'm so excited to hear about your story, but also about your thoughts about healthcare and where we're at and the state of things. So I thought maybe for our listeners, if we could start with your story. Where did you start and what brought you to this place here?
It's like many people out there, it's a somewhat convoluted story because for your listeners, they may or may not be aware, I just retired after 34 years in the Canadian Armed Forces. And my story in healthcare and my story with the military in Canada are inextricably linked. So I think if I was to go back to where did all this start? Well, definitely from my birth family, both my mom and my dad were members of armed forces. My dad was a submariner in the Royal Canadian Navy, and my mom was a Royal Navy nurse. She was a midwife with the British Navy.
Wow.
And they met. They met, and, well, they had a family. But I think from the earliest days, mom was always a nurse, and dad was always a former sailor. And we moved a lot as I was growing up, and it's partly because my dad pursued the work. We moved from, I was born in England, moved to Canada, and we always needed to have stuff that grounded us as a nuclear family because I come from a very small family, and we lived in northern Manitoba and here and there in northern Ontario. So when we hit Thunder Bay, Ontario, my dad rejoined the Naval Reserves in Thunder Bay, and I was old enough to join Navy League, which is under 13 group. And then I went on to become a Royal Canadian Sea Cadet. And why was that important? Because it gave me a grounding in being the kid who always moved and always the new kid. And very rapidly, we moved yet again to Southern Ontario, and I became an exchange student in Australia. And this is really where my healthcare journey began as a, what do I do now? So because Australia was on a different school year, I came back and I had to go back to high school. But psychologically, I was moving on from there. And in Ontario at the time, we had grade 13 if you wanted to go to university. So I came back and finished my grade 12. And I remember looking around and thinking, I'm going to join the military. And I went down to the recruiting center, and good Lord, this would have been in like 1983. Sorry, listeners. In 1983, and I said, I would like to be what is now a naval warfare officer. In other words, someone who drives a ship. And they said, you can be a nurse. And I went, oh, all right then. So I went back and I said, I can be a nurse. And remember, my mom was a nurse and I loved MASH. It was one of my favorite shows. And so I went to Niagara College because I couldn't stay for a couple of credits into grade 13. I needed to move on, get into high school. And I went to Mac Center for Nursing Education, which was part of Niagara College at that time. An important note, the oldest school of nursing in Canada. And it was stood up under the Florence Nightingale model, the first in Canada. And it was meant to look after workers who were building, I think it was the second Welland Canal that joins the Great Lakes up. So I went off and I became a registered nurse. 3-year diploma program, I taught my course. And I go back to the recruiting center and I said, I would like to be a naval warfare officer, ship driver. And they said, you can be a nurse. And I went, okay. So I started this kind of dual career. I was working at the St. Catharines General Hospital. I'd consolidated in the intensive care unit and I carried on as a registered nurse. And as I was working there, it took about 18 months and then I went to basic training. And I was recruited as a naval nurse. And off I went to basic training. And that really is where my health leadership journey continued. So just so you know, nurses have worn uniforms in Canada since the Northwest events. And there, it's been a place where women could lead but be accepted by society. So off I go and I join in January of 1989, which is when the federal government said that the Canadian Armed Forces can no longer exclude women under employment equity from any occupation. And I joined the month of that happened. But it was actually very important as a leader and as a healthcare provider. So I go in as one of the most traditional occupations you can possibly imagine, a nurse in the military. First Canadian women to vote were World War I nurses in France at a federal level. And so I go in and society's changing. So as a clinician, I joined and I went to National Defense Medical Center in Ottawa, which was one of the last military hospitals that existed, built during the Cold War. And the world was rapidly changing. And very shortly after I joined, the Cold War ended. Oh my goodness, I feel a little telling you this. But what did it mean for me as this very, very junior nurse? Well, I brought a few things to the table. I came in as a civilian critical care nurse. So regardless of my age, regardless of my years of experience, critical care nurses, for those of your audience who work in that domain, you tend to be fairly confident in what you need to do. Mm-hmm. If something needs to be done, you do it. Well, it gelled very nicely with a military career. So anyway, the Cold War ended, and I ended up going to, very shortly thereafter, the first crisis in the Gulf with one Canadian field hospital as a sub-lieutenant critical care nurse, meaning a very junior ward nurse in a field hospital that was meant to go and work with the British. And then I came back and the military's changing and things are changing. And then I went to Somalia in 1993 with the Canadian Airborne Regiment. And this is really where, as a health leader, as a military nurse, things really changed. When I came back, we were going through the process of effectively dismantling the Canadian Armed Forces for a peace dividend. What did that mean for healthcare? So also, the other point I'll bring forward is the Canadian Armed Forces has the 14th health jurisdiction in Canada. So it's our completely our own independent healthcare system opportunity for a health leader. We don't belong to provinces, we don't belong to territories, and under the British North America Act and the Canada Health Act, the Canadian Armed Forces are excluded. So I went in as a junior nurse, I guess, okay with myself as a critical care nurse, and was given opportunities because there really was no one else left to start leading as a junior nurse. So instead of kind of the traditional, well, you need 5 years to do this and 10 years to do this, I guess someone recognized I had enough leadership that they gave me opportunities. So it kind of marked the beginning of my career and health leadership. But I think if you're saying, that's nice, that's an interesting story, but in retrospect, looking at who I was, because remember, nurses always work for someone else. Someone else always had, we call it the comms, had the communication and the leadership, generally positions, and that's the way that it is, and that was okay. But I have to tell you, the one thing that I was able to bring and marry up, like I said earlier, was military leadership as a nurse, and being given the ability to meld the two and say, why are we here in our independent health jurisdiction that doesn't report to a province or a territory? So the thing I look back on is that I know in retrospect, something that was always really important to me is small L leadership for those that we serve, that in this case were patients. In my case, they were also military members or veterans as well, that it absolutely was important to me that in order to truly do what became patient-centered care, if something was wrong or my patients needed something, I needed to speak out. But the military gave me a structure to do that. So one of the things that I think in retrospect that was very important was not empowered in a way we know it today, but in very early days, feeling empowered in myself, focusing on those that we serve moving forward. So regardless of what I've done for the rest of my career, that has definitely driven me. Doesn't matter whether I'm a military or I was a military leader or a healthcare leader, it was always about those we served. And then as my career progressed, I had many exceptional opportunities as a health leader, but things that probably on the civilian side that we wouldn't think of, but it's what built me into who I am today. You don't always seek out opportunities. They're often thrust in front of you and you're pushed into them. So throughout my career, I was given an opportunity, often as the first nurse, to do something, whether it would be to lead a major health center, military health center in Halifax. I was the first non-physician to do that. Whether it was to be the commandant of our medical education and training school that included providing primary programs for early paramedicine and physician assistants, being given the opportunity to help transform a physician's assistants into something that's been accepted in a number of provinces in Canada. So through health leadership that way, and as my career progressed over the years, just as a small segue in there, I did go back to university as a junior nurse and finished my degree at the University of Ottawa. And I also became a primary healthcare nurse practitioner. And while primary care was not something I'd done a lot of, I was the critical care person, I have to tell you, my background, my leadership, my ability to make decisions that I learned as a critical care nurse with a military twist really helped me. So my career has been definitely unique. I've been given opportunities, not necessarily because I put my hand up for them or applied for the job. It was determined that I was the right person to try it. As my career progressed, I also was given opportunities to lead on operations. So for example, and again, these are all things that help build confidence as a leader, but also instill humility as you work along. That's another reflection I've had. My last large deployment was to Afghanistan, but it was originally for the combat mission down in the south in Kandahar, but ended up as Canada chose to step into reconstruction post-combat, I use quote marks there, in Kabul. And I went on to not only do the initial planning, but also to be the initial leader for a binational team to reestablish the medical education and training system for the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police. So I did many things after that, but if I focused there, I can tell you that that was one of the most rewarding things I'd ever done in my life. It felt like a culmination of everything I had done as a clinician, meaning you have to understand what it is that you're trying to lead. And I talk about training and education here. And then secondly, as a leader, a health leader, I was also able to work in, you know, binational, a U.S.-Canadian team, along with our Afghan colleagues, to help them, and this is my next part, putting them at the center of everything that we tried to do, help them redevelop physician internship programs, continue nursing programs, start physician assistant programs, et cetera. So my journey has been very varied. A number of not nursing positions after I came back from Afghanistan, but I can tell you, I became a senator in November of last year, but everything that I'd done to date as a health leader, but as well as a leader in the military, really led me up to where I am now and trying at the most natural level to continue to serve my country and help focus on not only diversity, equity, and inclusion, but also to try and help transform this healthcare system at a policy and legislative issue. And that's kind of where I am now. I know there's many other steps in there, but those were the highlights for me.
Your career is amazing and very fascinating and clearly very diverse. And what really struck me was this idea that in many, many instances, you didn't necessarily put your hand up for leadership or a leadership role, but it was imposed on you or sent your way. And so what I'm curious about is, given that you didn't necessarily put your hand up for leadership, what self-doubt or worries did you have about taking on these roles that maybe you weren't looking for?
I think that is a really good question, because I have to include a gender perspective in here, and also nurses very much come from part of that. Is that if you think about the military, the most traditional power-based hierarchical gendered, meaning white man type organization, it's not a judgment, it's a statement.
Yeah,
I had every reason to feel like, oh my goodness, I couldn't do it. So why did I think I could do it? I think it was the courage, well, why not? Somebody had to have believed in me. And so in other words, I had trust in the system that they were making the right choice. And the next thing I also knew is that I had a network of people around me that were not just other women, they were women and men who came not just from the healthcare field, but also came from the people we support, from the Army primarily, from the Navy, like senior leaders in the military who were there to actually support me to do this. Now, if I go back and I step back, because one of my final roles in the military from 2018 until I actually finished my active duty in December of 22, I was the defense champion for women and an interim champion for Defense Team Pride Network, for example. But the one thing I'm very aware of is the fact that women, and let me add nurses in this particular, because we are a fairly genderized occupation, even though we're getting more diverse, is that I think imposter syndrome is something that many of us suffer from. And this is where I think, especially if I add the military surrounding to it, we often feel like we have to change who we are in order to fit in. And so once I started reading and being authentic me, I'm always a nurse. It doesn't matter that I'm a general officer, flag officer, they call it. I was a rear admiral, so you know, a flag officer. It doesn't matter that I'm that. I do it from the position of what I believe in that comes from, you know, kind of personified in nursing. So imposter syndrome can be something that many people, for many reasons, many intersections of identity or position can certainly suffer from. And I think that you need mentors. I think that you need trailblazers. And it maybe just have been part of me. It's like, oh, yeah, let me try. I'll give it a try. And then feeling safe that if I made a mistake, it wouldn't be the end of everything. And that was the environment in which I worked. So if I was to, you know, advise either young military people or young healthcare providers now that want to go on and lead their system, big L leaders, meaning I'm in a formal leadership position, or small L leaders because people see that you have something to pull for you, it's going to be very, very, very important is that you find someone that you trust that can help you shape, help you understand, provide you perspective, also known as a mentor. And that when you're trying to find an organization, not only does salary matter and the position title and all the other factors, one of the questions that I think I would want people to ask is, what's it like to work here? Is this an environment where I can feel psychologically safe? I can be my authentic self. And I think in retrospect, that's certainly somewhere where the Canadian Armed Forces is trying to go to address some cultural challenges. But I think in healthcare in general, it very, very much fits who we are as an organization. You know, we're so busy looking after, especially do direct interface at the clinical level, caring for other people, we often forget to care for ourselves. But as people who are in the system, we have every right not only to ask, what's my position, how much vacation do I get, but having the ability to talk to others in the system to see whether it actually is an environment that they want to work and grow in, because I think that's when people can be the best leaders. And also, let's face it, you benefit your patients if you're a good leader.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what I'm definitely hearing is that you had support around you, and you also were firmly rooted in your identity as a nurse, but the values that come with that, your own personal values, but the values that come with being in service to others as a nurse. And so, you know, what you're saying around people looking for environments that are going to support them and nurture them and looking for people that will do the same thing, I think is really, really important as we try and shape the work environments that we are in.
It's about creating resiliency to build through crisis, because I think all of us come to the table with a skill set, the functional task-based management, like the widgets and whatnots of what we bring to the table. But the thing that helps us get through crisis, not completely, but it helps us get through crisis, is resiliency within your team. I would say team, because those that influence your everyday working, it allows you, even when you have to take that, you know, it's like doing the final sprint at the end of a marathon, gives you that resiliency to weather it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'd add to what you shared there.
I think resiliency is one of those things that obviously is come to the front of mind, really forefront of mind in healthcare as a result of COVID. Now, it was there before. Obviously, we needed resiliency before, but definitely it's clear that this is something that we need to focus on.
Very much so. And I don't think there's a formula for resiliency, but I also think that we can certainly provide structures for people. And it isn't just, here's your course, this is how you do mindfulness, this is how you breathe. Like, we're healthcare workers, right? You know, just be careful, because we're like, yeah, no, thank you. Who's the worst patient? Often a healthcare provider. But but what we actually need to do is realize, like any determinant of health, determinants of healthy workplaces include psychological safety in the workspace. I'm going to also say the ability to say no, which we do in healthcare, as you know. So yes, resiliency needs to be addressed as a public health issue within healthcare. Maybe starting at when I'm doing my basic education as a PICUL provider, I don't care who you are.
It strikes me as it's almost a bit of a unique and almost radical idea that resiliency is a public health issue within healthcare. It's a public health issue, but especially within healthcare.
Within healthcare. And if you think about it, healthcare, we often think bricks and mortar all the time. we have in our current system of healthcare delivery, or really a Cold War structure where it's focused on bricks and mortar, tertiary prevention. We forget that there are people, whether you be a personal support worker, you be an RPN, you name it, that through the prevention piece is that it has to exist everywhere as well. I have to get that message home. My role as a senator, I meet with people from personal support workers who feel like they have been lost in the system through to people who are working. They do tend to work tertiary, but people who work in bricks and mortar who also feel like they're forgotten. So if we all feel like we're forgotten, it tells me that it is a public health issue, public health for healthcare. We have to care about ourselves as much as we care about our patients.
Yeah, and I think that's something that in healthcare has not occurred on a regular basis. As you said, healthcare professionals tend to be the worst patients. You know, the idea of people feeling forgotten, one, it's heartbreaking. And it's heartbreaking on so many levels that people are feeling that way on a personal level, but also that somehow we have created a system that has allowed for that. So what do you see? So in your role now as senator, what do you see as needing to change?
I think it's a really good question. And as a new senator, you work on what is my role in all of this. And I think that when I look at spheres of influence, whether it's patients, it's the work that we do, is quite important to understand. And as a federal senator of Canada, our sphere of influence really is at the national legislation and policy issue. So I also know, like, I like to pull pieces together as a good military planner, you know, and pulling it all together. And the next thing is, well, health is a provincial responsibility. Well, our federal structure says each piece is interconnected, whether you choose money as your focus or you choose legislation and policy. So only way out of this is going to be how we do it together. So what is my role as a senator? I am a senator for Ontario as well. So there are levers that the federal government, and that's not me, I'm not government, just so you know, that we have at the federal level. One of them is a Canada Health Act. We've had little meows at it trying to do updates to it, but maybe given what COVID has shown us, it needs to be opened and completely reviewed before we just keep putting Band-Aids on it, adding a little extra clause here, a little extra clause there. So I certainly think as a federal senator, again, I'm not an elected politician, but we can certainly do things to help put heat and light on the Canada Health Act, the federal legislation bit that directly and inextricably impacts on each province and territory. And why do I say that? Because if you think about it, healthcare is a provincial delivery requirement. Provincial and territorial legislation around healthcare delivery derives a lot of its powers out of British North America Act and the Canada Health Act. So you do one and you can do another. So one of the things that you can do at the federal level is look at that as a lever, but working collaboratively with provinces and territories. I'm talking legislation now. I promise to bring this down a bit. And then the second thing is about the people who do healthcare. And as a healthcare provider with ability to see everything, this is my observation, even when I worked in the Canadian Armed Forces, leading the whole healthcare system, the 14th health jurisdiction. Remember, it's federal, so we get to see what all the provinces and territories do. The one thing that I think that we can do, and I say we, and I'll explain that in a minute, is that the solution in where we need to go has to come from the people who do the work. I can give you money, I can give you legislation and policy, but that needs to be shaped beyond the political level, provincial or federal. And why do I say that? Because if you don't do healthcare, it's easy to say, well, that costs too much, I'm not doing it, right? That's an easy approach. But what if we tried to truly apply, you know, public health in the way it's meant to? It really is about the people who receive the product or deliver the product, the patient partnered triad that we have going on there that need to have a voice. So how do we do better as a way ahead, and how can I contribute to that to make sure it isn't just, well, the doctors say this, well, the nurses don't even exist, whether it's provincial or federal bodies that pull it together. I think that as a senator, I can help contribute to pulling together the separate groups. So this excellence and expertise on how to run these systems can be brought together. So that's kind of how I see that going. And I'm going to take it down one more notch here. The other thing is this is my observation as a registered nurse still in the province of Ontario, is registered nurses make up the backbone of healthcare in Canada, professionalized healthcare in Canada. I don't see them. I don't see their voice. I don't hear their voice. And it's not because anybody wishes to exclude it, but I truly believe that any approach that's taken provincially, federally, et cetera, needs to make sure that the key stakeholders in this, physicians, and especially primary care and family medicine in particular, nurses and all their stripes, pharmacists, physiotherapy, you name it, that we actually create a stakeholder group where everybody has an equal amount of power, as I like to say, in it to actually bring their voice to the table and try and look at how we can move forward with health reform. So as a senator, going back to where I am, so the other things that we can bring to the table, there's at least 6 senators right now, there are more, but who have a core healthcare background. And we come from, primarily physician, but we come from many different backgrounds. So I think that the next thing that Senate can do is we can start looking at federal studies that drive legislation. Have you ever heard of the Kirby Report?
This is what we're out.
Right. Kirby's from the Senate. The one thing about having an appointed Senate that doesn't fall prey to the every 4-year election cycles is that we can start studies and continue them, even though you got to reintroduce them with each new parliament. So one thing that House senators could do, and I hope will do, is we will do basically Kirby and Romanoff 2.0. Where are we? Where do we need to go? And why? Because one thing about being a senator is that we can ask any Canadian to come in, any diverse group of Canadians, from providers to patients to public health advocates to poverty groups, you name it. Anyway, so that is something that hopefully we will figure out what we can do and make recommendations. And then the last thing I will add is elected members of parliament will always be the lead. That is who Canadians have voted in. But we also work collaboratively on an interparliamentary basis with the people in the elected side of the house. And the other thing that we can also do for Canadians is have them say, you need to talk to doctors, yes, but you also need to talk to nurses and you need to talk to as they move through their studies. So I know it sounds very esoteric, but I can tell you we can do this to set the conditions that as provinces who are now, as you know, doing bilateral healthcare agreements with the federal government, is that it then helps drive provincial change. Mm-hmm. And overlapping all of this, that every single person who listens to this podcast who is a Canadian and who believes in universally insured healthcare, it is going to be critical that we get together and make sure that we as a grouping are able to put our marker down to make it important in provincial politics that you need to listen. This is where the province of Alberta, Ontario, you pick it, needs to go in order to do health reform. And in a generation, maybe we'll pull all the pieces together and see some change. But I recognize fundamentally it doesn't change the current situation for so many of our healthcare providers, regardless of whether they work in the community, if they are personal support workers in our seniors' homes, our most vulnerable. They have to be able to weather the storm until we can get to systemic change. And I think therein lies our biggest challenge.
There's so much in there that I think is really important. And the idea of weathering the storm until we can get to systemic change, I think, is really the key to getting to where we want to go. And what I appreciate in what you're saying is there's so much vision there. And there is a picture of what it could be like. And that's exciting. And you know, that comes with a lot of challenge, a lot of hard work, and you know, it's a journey. You mentioned about change needs to come from those who provide the care.
And what I'm curious about is, with any like healthcare reform, what needs to shift in the perspective of the public to enable and empower that healthcare reform?
So I'm going to talk from my perspective. I don't talk from any official platform, but I'm going to go back to determinants of health.
Okay.
Social determinants of health. I mean, social, the whole enchilada. That when I talk about it needs to come from providers, providers can identify where the challenges are. So we truly believe that I'd rather prevent something than have to treat the tertiary aspects of chronic illness, impact poverty, et cetera. I think that some of the early day stuff is, how do we deal with the here and now? Change management really is about, you know, it's system of systems. Systems of systems till you get the outcome that you're looking at. But with that, I think that we need to start at the educational levels. We need to build on successes we've already had, even though we wibble and wobble. How about anti-smoking and seatbelt laws? Why did we bring those into the first place? It was to prevent people. So I think that maybe we need to start going back and talking to provinces about their data, and what do we need to bring into health classes in primary school? About healthy eating, about managing your money, social determinants of health. What do we need to do? So I think there is an education component that is not health, but directly impacts on what our coalface care providers are seeing. Okay, so I think we need to have a look there. The next thing it is you talked about, well, how do we bring this into the eyes of the public? It has to matter to the public for it to be an issue. What has happened in our world now is we take things for granted. And I use my experience of serving overseas. I'll look at Afghanistan. You know, we could get really mad at people because they turn up in the emergency department to get their primary health care, right? But what we often forget is that we've taken every other thing out. We've assumed that they have healthy lifestyles. We assume that they have access to care providers. Mm-hmm. So, if I was to move forward on this, I would look at education. I would look at getting it out in front of the public. I'm going to use, because I was on the board of directors for Health Standard Organization, person partner care is absolutely critical. Patient and people, advocacy voices need to be front and center for any provincial or territorial ministry of health to hear what this needs to look like. So that's the next thing, make it about the people. Money. And then I think when you look at what the federal government does, I don't think our ability to say, oh, it's a provincial issue anymore, is acceptable. This is about us trying to move forward. And again, I'm moving backwards into the bigger strategic domain here. But I really think that Canadians, and as they go forward and vote, need to understand that your health is your security as a country, your security as a person, it's your income security, everything. Stop putting it over, taking it for granted, and put it out to one side. So yeah. I know there's tons more, but that's where I'd start.
Yeah, well, and I think you raise a really good point about making it important to people. It should be intuitively important to people, but as you said, sometimes we take things for granted. We forget about the impact and the role of healthcare on our own lives until we need it, of course, which I think is a very human thing. So this idea of how do we bring it back into view for everyone to recognize how important, critically important this is. I want to jump back just really quickly. You said something about nurses not having a voice, or you're not seeing them, you're not hearing them. And it's interesting because I've heard that from a couple of other guests as well, as, you know, bringing the nurses' voices to the table and ensuring that they have an equal amount of power as some of the other stakeholder groups, particularly physician groups. What I'm interested in hearing from you about that is, how do we do that? How do we make sure that all of the stakeholders have that equal place at the table with equal power, equal voice?
Is it equal or equitable? I don't know. And there is a difference in, yep, in the two terms. But I just put that out there. I actually think it is, bear with me here, this comes from culture. So mental models that we have, I serve someone else. We have legislation that says these are your gatekeepers in your system, guess about controlling money, which is not a nurse, and provide most of the care that goes on there. So any change in getting voice out there takes boldness and it takes trailblazers. We have amazing nurses out there. We have a chief nursing officer for Canada whom I've talked with. I mean, oh my goodness, that is amazing.
Yeah.
It's how do you knuckle your way into the system? It's taking that step, knowing that you're going to be resisted at every corner, and not because people are bad, it's because you're trying to change the way we've always done things. Well, we've always done it this way. So nurses who, in everyday conversation, well, you know, doctors and nurses, you always hear them mentioned. When it comes to having these huge influential places, you don't hear nursing. That's the first part. I'll also use me as well. My example is when I was told I was changing occupations because I couldn't be a nurse anymore, I was going to go lead the system. It took me a long time. Well, you're not a nurse anymore. You are never not a nurse. So even if you go on to lead health systems, of which we have some wonderful senior people who have nursing backgrounds leading the system, you have to be proud of the fact that you are a nurse. Intuitively, our other colleagues in healthcare, oh, yeah, the nurses, right? But they forget, but you're a health executive now. You're a bean counter. You're a policy log. You're a PhD. You can only count socks on the shelf. So I think the other thing we have to do in nursing is not only take that bold step forward in conversations we're not at, we'll say, hey, why am I not at the table? Boldly speak that out from our health nursing leaders. And then on creating controversy for some of your listeners. And then the next thing is for the people who choose to step forward in this domain, that other nurses have to support them. Unfortunately, nursing has a traditional history, which is quite often in more oppressed occupations, is that we eat our young, and it still happens today, and I watch it happen. And so the next thing is nurses, even if that person is a health executive in whatever, or the deputy minister of health of a province or a territory, is that other nurses have to be there to hold them up and not tear them down. And because I actually do not think that it will be too hard for nurses to truly assume an equal voice at the table as it comes to health reform in Canada. I do believe it is possible, but it's going to take a lot of boldness and being there to step forward. And if I reflect back on my career, I know I was able to do that because there were others who owned the power who supported me. My observation over the year, especially as a senior health leader and now as a senator, is there's a lot of people out there who are not nurses who are willing to do that. So allyship as well is the next point I would add to that. Can we do it? Yes, we can.
I love that. And I mean, I think, you know, your comments about being bold, finding the trailblazers and supporting each other, absolutely, you know, holding each other up as opposed to tearing each other down is so important. And it's interesting because, you know, it comes up quite often about the culture within nursing around the eat our young, or you have to, you know, put in your time and you have to suffer like I suffered. It's very prevalent. And so it's about shifting that culture within nursing as well, so that we can emerge in the role that we need to be and play the part that we need to play within healthcare, be the leaders we need to be within healthcare.
And realistically, I'm going to go back to my earlier comment about psychological safety. I'll use the military as example. The one thing that we do know is that change happens in each person. Yes, system comes after each person, and they tell two people, and they tell two people. Okay? So the area of influence for nurses really does start at that team level, wherever it is that you work, whatever it is that you do. And that's where you can start modeling the behavior, especially as we're trying to get more and more people into nursing in Canada, right? Mm-hmm. And that they can actually see that this isn't just somebody's handmade. This is a place where I can really thrive. That an occupation that when I started nursing, we were still fighting against someone needed to tell you how to count drips, right? was a little bit past that, but close enough, that the rapid professionalism of nurses can be actually realized, but it has to be done by those people at the team level go, no, that is within my scope of practice. I've influenced that. Well, yes, I like where you're going with this.
Yeah. So first off, I'll say well said on that. I think there's so much potential for the nursing field to emerge into where they need to be. And as we wrap up and come to a close, what I'm curious is, what words of wisdom, what advice would you offer for leaders of in any role or any capacity? What would you offer them?
I think that I'd probably focus more on, if you are not seeing the change that you know needs to happen, then you have to start doing business differently. But if you do business differently, you need to do it with the people who are going to have to live that change. And if we don't change, our system will fail. That is what I believe.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Very powerful thoughts.
It sounds kind of negative, and for that, I do apologize. It isn't. I think there's a massive potential. Let's realize it.
Yeah. And it's real. Like, let's realize it within the reality. Thank you, Senator Patterson. I am so grateful for you sharing your story and your thoughts and your ideas and your passion. What came through throughout our conversation today was you were so dedicated to healthy Canadians and the people who support that, you know, regardless of what profession they may be in or what role or what place, you're dedicated to them. So I'm grateful for you and I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Leah. I really appreciate speaking with you today.
Thanks so much for joining us today at Central Line, Leadership in Healthcare. Also, if you liked what you heard, please head on over to Apple Podcasts to leave us a review. Be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Also, if you'd like to learn more about our host, Leah Woodchick, check out talltreesleadership.com.